The Poor Pearl's Almanac began as a conversation between two friends on a road trip only a few months prior to the start of COVID. Talking about the general state of things, it was clear that it didn't feel like things could continue the way they were. The increasingly erratic nature of our political system and the disconnect of market forces from market realities highlighted how, as individuals, we felt as though the world was becoming further and further untethered. From what? We weren't really sure. After discussing what a podcast would look like and if it was even worth doing, the idea subsided. And then COVID struck. The grim realization that our concerns were becoming realized, that COVID was stressing the already frayed state of our global commerce system, made it abundantly clear that there was merit to our concerns, that the United States was wildly unprepared for any global catastrophe, and that our political system was ill-prepared for resistance from the right. With things shut down, we went to work. In August of 2020, on the heels of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death and the impending Trump-Biden election, we casually discussed our expectations of the 2020 election, and we were discomfortingly correct. We narrowed down three likely options. Trump won, and things would continue to deteriorate. The election wouldn't happen under the guise of some greater issue, a Trump-manufactured swamp revolt or something along those lines. Or that Biden would win and that Trump would urge his followers to claim his rightful place as president. My personal belief, as I explained in that episode, had been the latter, and I was right. What I underestimated was the right's inability to materially overthrow the government. That many expected the forces of Q to somehow mystically make that change, unlike the efforts we've covered extensively in even modern right-wing white supremacy action. Today, nearly 4 years later, things are very different and somehow exactly the same. We face the same election. Biden, barely holding onto power within his own party, offers nothing to working-class people, promising to make changes if re-elected, ignoring the fact that he's currently the one in power and can make those changes today, instead of teasing the public with promises to make marginal improvements in the lives of the millions struggling across the nation, while continuing to fund the bombing campaigns of Israel. Dominic Guanzin, our editor, lives in the Chicago area, and we decided it was time to get some boots on the ground. While the chant that this is the most important election of our lives feels hollow, I'm reminded of that scene from The Office Space when Peter visits a therapist, and the therapist calls out Peter's claim that every day is the worst day of his life. At one point, point blank, he asks Peter, "Is today the worst day of your life?" Peter pauses in earnest thought, and he responds that yes, it is the worst day of his life. Instead of delegitimizing Peter's claim, which wouldn't be hard to do, surely the day of a car accident, the death of a family member, and so on, would be considerably worse than a day at work and with a therapist, he simply responds with, "Man, that's fucked up." And I feel like that's where we're at. FDR's re-election was likely the most important election for the survival of humanity. That doesn't erase the very grim reality we exist under, in the millions of different scenarios that could play out with this current election. We can both admit that this is the most important election of our lives and understand the limitations of the two-party election system, and that while 80 or 90% of things will stay the same, that 10 or 20% may be wildly different and cause unintended consequences. What do I mean by that? Thinking back to our episode 4 years ago, I'd made the case that a Trump election may have been a less destructive path. I got a lot of flack for that, but my argument was simple. Trump's policies were often less damaging than his capacity to foment hatred and divide. While the right marched on the streets through his presidency, more hate crimes have been committed in 2023 than in any of the years of his presidency. It's much easier to coalesce against something than to build. My belief, and I stand by it, is that if we were at the end of Trump's second term today, he would happily ride out his belief that he was the best president ever, especially on the cusp of huge economic collapse. Today, the man running for office has policies far to the right of his policies 4 years ago. The implicit language has been replaced by explicit language, while he has worked to revitalize his base. The many people who felt Trump's novelty had worn thin and would have grown to tire of him, and even did 4 years ago, the only reason Biden was elected. Today, he's a symbolic fuck you to the Democrats' incapacity to create any material improvements in the lives of working people. In many ways, 4 years without Trump has accelerated right-wing politics by decades. And that's where the Democratic Party stands today. An external fuck you collectively from Republicans, independents, and even most Democrats at this point. And that's why I think this Democratic Party convention may be the most interesting in our lives.
For the Poor Pearls Almanac, I'm Dominic Guanzon. And for the past 3 years, I've been the audio editor for this show, removing Elliot's ums and ahs, deleting Matt's pauses, and expunging Andy's worst jokes.
But not, apparently, taking out my big gulps, as we found out.
Yes, that was a slip-up on my part. But you stay hydrated out there. That's what's important.
Someone's got to do it.
So we call him Big Gulp now.
That's what they call me, Big Gulp.
There you go. I'm also not a journalist or a lawyer, nor am I even an actual Chicagoan, though I am working on that last one. But what I am is, like you, a poor prole. And one with a recorder, a camera, and basic knowledge of the CTA. This week, I'll be in Chicago's Near West Side. That's a couple miles straight west of the central downtown area, you know, where the Bean is.
Flick the Bean.
That holy beacon of Chicago.
It's been freed, by the way. It was under construction for like 4 months, but now it's been free. Everyone was saying, free the Bean.
That's why they call it Bean Town, right?
bean curds, yeah.
What's the actual name of it? It's like Skygate or...
Close. The actual name is Cloud Gate.
This is actually why we keep Dom around, is for like trivia night.
I've never done a trivia night, but I feel like I'd be good at it.
Yeah, you would. I'm taking you. Next time you're in the real Bean Town, we're going trivia.
The Near West Side is a nice part of town, home to Fulton Market in West Loop, the collection of hospitals and research centers that make up the Illinois Medical District, the earliest surviving Al's Beef, and University of Illinois Chicago, or UIC. If you're ever in the area, the Fulton Street Collective on Hubbard is an excellent art gallery and jazz venue, not too far from the Green Line. But for this special moment of time in mid-August, the entire city and the country has once again laid its attention upon the United Center, the 23,500-seat arena where Michael Jordan made crowds roar in raw elation throughout the 90s.
Raw elation.
Raw elation.
Just want to reinforce that.
For real, though.
I really want to drive that home.
If you ever want to be, like, hype, watch any 90s-era Chicago Bulls intro, where they're announcing the names as they go into the arena, and it's insane.
Can also watch Space Jam, same thing.
It's exact same thing. At the beginning of Jordan's second three-peat championship run, Bill Clinton breezed through his renomination for president at the 1996 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, as hundreds of delegates and Hillary Clinton herself danced to the Macarena.
In Chicago, delegates took time out in between speakers to do a new dance called the Macarena.
But that was the DNC of 1996. Today, it's the DNC of 2024.
And fortunately, Joe Biden is forever gone.
Dun, dun, dun.
A lot has happened to the Democrats, to Chicago, the U.S., and the world since Los Del Rios debuted their album A Mí Me Gusta. The genocide in Gaza, the housing crisis, trans panic, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, cost of living rising faster than you can shout the fash in fascism. The current president's brain is metaphorically shot, and the former president's brain was almost shot. Oh yeah, and most of the working class hasn't quite bounced back from 2020 just yet. You could also argue they haven't bounced back since the 2008 recession. Worst of all, my favorite streamer just got canceled and I've got nothing left.
Tom, I'm so sorry.
Oh boy, who was it?
It was you. You stopped streaming after like a week or two. Because you have a Twitch, right?
Oh yeah.
I do have a Twitch, yeah. We used it like a year or two ago.
You were, I remember I was watching live and you were doing a thing on mason jars or something. It was really cool.
Oh, yeah. I want to bring it back so we can do a live stream of Doomsday Preppers. Yeah. That is on the agenda. Now that it's been recorded, I have to do it.
2024 is a funny and sad and weird time to be a poor, poor prole. And yet there still exists that morbid curiosity to see what that really means and how it can be changed. This week, I'm more of the former, looking at a group of people working towards the latter. A coalition of over 90 local and national organizations have come together in the run-up to the 2024 DNC, including political parties like the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, social justice groups like Black Lives Matter Chicago, and the Arab American Action Network, also based here in the city. Even the Illinois chapter of Starbucks Workers United has signed on. Together, they have come to call themselves the Coalition to March on the DNC. I spoke with Fayani Aboma-Majana, a spokesperson for the coalition and a member of one of its many organizations. We discussed a number of things, including how they got started in this growing movement.
I'm a member of the Chicago Alliance Against Racism and Political Oppression. We're an organization that was founded in 1973 out of the movement to free Angela Davis and other political prisoners. I joined the organization in 2019, and I was involved in organizing protests around the 2020 uprisings, and then the fight to advance police accountability in Chicago. So, you know, in our view, police crimes are a question of self-determination for Black people in this country. And so that's an area of struggle that I'm, you know, deep in. And the Chicago Alliance, you know, whenever we heard the DNC was coming around to Chicago, us, the U.S. Palestinian Community Network, SDS at UIC, we came together and we decided to form a coalition to march on the DNC. Initially, we were going to form a coalition around people's demands, you know, like demands around labor rights, police crimes, LGBTQIA plus rights, women's reproductive rights, you know, all these different areas that are very important. And then October 7th happened and everything changed in the political dynamic in this country.
On the coalition's website, their main demand is made clear and bold. Stand with Palestine. End U.S. aid to Israel. Words such as massacres, genocide, and murder are employed in the short but stern explanation of the nine-month siege. The term apartheid Israel, in particular, hearkening back to the ongoing boycott, disinvestment, and sanctions movement, which itself is also drawing upon Chicago's history with the original BDS movement for South African apartheid, which we don't have time to cover. But know there exists a lineage of international solidarity through that people power. The headlining statement also zooms out to admonish the geopolitical and economic roots of the issue. Quote,
Israel is the USA's landed aircraft carrier in the Middle East to control the region with its huge oil reserves for the profits of U.S. corporations. Those corporations and banks are at the core of an empire that inflicts mass violence to extract profit all around the globe at the expense of people and the planet.
In the spirit of intersectionality, the website's demands page also lists a series of hot-button issues from the leftist perspective.
Money for jobs, school, healthcare, housing, and environment, not for war. Immigrant rights and legalization for all. Defend LGBTQIA+ and reproductive rights. Defend the right to unionize and strike. Stop police crimes. Community control of the police now. Justice, peace, and equality.
In case it hasn't been apparent, the coalition isn't afraid to go after not just Biden, but the Democrats as a whole. In a statement released on the 1st of January, the coalition makes its stance clear. Joe Biden and the Democratic Party are responsible for the Israeli genocide against Gaza. It goes on.
Democratic politicians who are progressive except for Palestine, such as Jan Schakowsky, Katie Porter, Debbie Dingell, and Mark Polkan, plus Chicago-based legislators who can represent a huge constituency of Palestinians and Arabs, like Sean Casson, Dick Durbin, and Tammy Duckworth, have been the targets of protests and call campaigns.
There was one mention of the GOP in that statement.
The Democratic and Republican Party leaders are in lockstep when it comes to support for the apartheid entity and repression of pro-Palestinian protests in the U.S.
But it's clear the coalition is not letting go of Gaza or the Democrats' culpability.
I think a lot of people get lost in the personal demeanor, the demeanor of this or that individual. Ultimately, they're just individuals who uphold the larger order of the Democratic Party leadership. That order of upholding these corporate interests that, you know, see to it that there are these endless wars because it's very profitable for a few people. That is who the Democrats ultimately serve. There's this leadership that ensures that that's the case. And so Kamala Harris and everyone else, they're just representatives of that order.
Indeed, the first half of election year 2024 has seen an exponential rise of discourse, calls to action, and protests on the topic of Palestine. It seems the new heights with which Israeli leadership is continuing its settler colonialism and the terrorism it creates was just too much this time. A majority of that leftist American anger has been solidly pointed at the Democrats, which came to a head in late April and early May. Student protests across the U.S. those weeks were met with startling domestic images reminiscent of the Vietnam anti-war protests. At UCLA, a student camp came under assault by counter-protesters who used poles, clubs, projectiles, and fists to besiege the makeshift barricades.
Video captured May 1st on the UCLA campus shows this masked man holding a pole. Then he throws it toward the pro-Palestinian encampment. There are also pictures showing the same man holding a metal barrier. UCLA police have arrested the masked man, 18-year-old Idan Ahn, for felony assault with a deadly weapon. Isabella Crone Barone is a UCLA student.
I mean, I'm glad that there's finally action being taken against those instigators, and yet at the same time, I don't think UCLA PD or UCLA administration has done nearly enough to go after the instigators.
UCLA administration responded by saying they should have had the police remove the camp first, you know, for safety reasons. In Columbia University in New York, protesters occupying a school building were met with police escalation from a counterterrorism unit at the behest of school administration.
Police trying to retake control of Hamilton Hall on the campus of Columbia University last night. There were traps at every turn.
Let's deploy a flashback.
And they deployed plenty of them. They used power saws to cut through chains protesters had used to keep them out. And battering rams to break into rooms that were locked, one room at a time.
The siege was covered by WKCR-FM, the student-run radio station, in harrowing detail.
I don't know what division of police officers this is, but they have a ton of, industrial tools, emergency services. They have sledgehammers. Oh, they are now disrupting the barricade. They're pulling students from the entrance of the admissions office here at Hamilton Hall.
Thank you, Sawyer. So I'm getting reports from Teddy now that there may be an unconscious student in front of Hamilton. Do you have any further confirmation of that, Teddy?
Yeah, I have a view of video from someone in Harley looking down onto Hamilton. And yes, there's an unconscious student on the ground. They have removed most of the debris and furniture on the side. And there's an unconscious
people
student
are
on
being,
the side on the ground.
Or exiting campus in the sort of zip tie handcuffs here. I can recognize these people from the barricade. These are
at the University of Chicago, the one in the South Side Bernie Sanders graduated from, not to be confused with University of Illinois Chicago. Encampments were treated with little to no violence, but four student demonstrators were suspended in late May, 1 week before graduation. One of them, Youssef Hasway, did not receive his diploma that spring.
UChicago just took away my degree the week of graduation. UChicago notified me and three other seniors that we can walk at graduation but won't be getting our diplomas. UChicago has already had me arrested. Also, they put only me, the only Palestinian in the room, in handcuffs. Let's talk about that.
In a June 28th Instagram post, he writes,
UChicago has morally dissipated and savagely denied me a place to be Palestinian. Some of my earliest memories here include a Zionist-led smear campaign my freshman year. I've heard some of the most vile things about me and a magnitude of hateful anti-Palestinian rhetoric, and it's only gotten worse as I've made my exit. I'm drained to a level I've never experienced. But yet, I can't help to think of all the Palestinians in Gaza that are drained to a level I can't imagine. I've been robbed of 4 years, but they've been robbed of a lifetime. I was going to dedicate my diploma in this post to all of the students of Gaza who didn't get an academic year because it was canceled. That'll have to wait. More importantly, I'm dedicating this to all the students in Gaza who will never walk a stage again.
Much more happened throughout those hectic few weeks of collegiate civil disobedience. We once again don't have time to go over it all in detail, but no, it was a flashpoint in the national consciousness. Politically, it galvanized the left and center-left even more, and gave those who were unable to participate in 2020's protests a taste of civil disobedience and pepper spray. But now it's August, and a lot has happened in the world of news and politics. Trump got a Claire's-level ear piercing. Biden dropped out of the race after finally being convinced by America's political class. And Kamala Harris is the new meme darling and fundraising champion. The day after Biden's decision to drop out of the election, the coalition released the following truncated statement, quote,
"Genocide Joe Biden has stepped down from running for president as the Democratic Party nominee. His decision doesn't change the policies of the Democratic Party leadership, specifically their support of the genocide in Palestine. So our movement must continue to apply pressure. On August 19th, we will march on the DNC for Gaza, regardless of who gets nominated for the presidency. Democratic Party leadership switching out their presidential nominee does not wash the blood of over 50,000 Palestinians off their hands."
As the headlines fluctuate in topics of the horse race, the protesters' job remains clear. Keep Palestine on the mind. On the homepage of the coalition website, it shouts right at the top, "We are a coalition of organizations bringing our demands to the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 2024. The location listed right under? Union Park. But being allowed to protest at that location is a fight all its own. So far, 8 separate groups, including 3 from the coalition, have been in a back-and-forth legal battle over permits to march near the DNC at the United Center. For the coalition, the location is Union Park, just 4 to 5 city blocks away. It would be just a half-mile, 10-minute walk to the Arena of Delegates. Chicago's Elevated Train System, or L, would provide incredibly easy access via the green and pink lines at the Ashland Station, located literally at the corner of Union Park. Throughout most of 2024, these permits have been repeatedly denied by the city, citing traffic and police manpower issues. To quote Chicago Deputy Chief Gabriella Shamash from a court filing, "The required resources for this parade would include several hundred police officers, as well as the equipment those officers would need." 2 of the coalition groups, March for the People's Agenda and Students for a Democratic Society at UIC, attempted to appeal the city, but were again denied. The city did offer an alternative protest site along Columbus Drive at Grant Park. It's the premier tourist hotspot where Buckingham Fountain and the Art Institute provide Instagram-worthy shots, as well as the home of Lollapalooza. It's also a stone's throw away from The Bean.
The Bean.
And somewhat close to the McCormick Place, where the DNC's daytime activities are being held, but it's nowhere near the United Center, where the biggest pageantry will take place. For reference, the distance between Grant Park and the United Center is about the same distance as Times Square to the middle of Central Park. Alternatively, that's about the distance from Michael DeSantis' house in Grand Theft Auto V to the Los Santos International Airport.
Oh, okay. All this stuff mixed up. I'm clear now.
It is actually insane how much, like, people will know video game maps to heart, but they won't know their own neighborhoods.
I believe that.
Kids these days.
Grant Park is not an entirely useless location to protest, since DNC delegates could be staying in the ritzy hotels in the Loop, Chicago's downtown, just as they did in 1968. Funny enough, Grant Park is where a lot of the police violence took place 56 years ago. Particularly around the bronze General John Logan Memorial, where images of protesters rallying around and climbing the statue were etched into the national memory. In late June of 2024, a different coalition called Bodies Outside of Unjust Laws, this one mostly centered around reproductive and LGBT plus rights, were given the green light to a downtown-based march route after being denied permits for months. Again, it's a very visible location based in the most recognizable and commercial parts of Chicago, yet it still feels like a consolation prize, especially since it's taking place the day before the convention, though this could just be wanting to avoid a schedule conflict with the coalition. For their part, the coalition refused to take no for an answer and filed suit on a federal level. On June 12th, the city mostly caved and granted a permit to march much closer to the United Center, which includes a route right next to Union Park and is just a block away from the security zones established by the Secret Service. The coalition was encouraged but not satisfied, saying the proposed marching route is too small and takes too many turns in the smaller side streets, only 4 to 5 blocks wide and 2 blocks deep. The longest stretch on Lake Street is completely covered by the L, elevated track, Green Line, likely to obscure some of the scale of the protest, though providing some cover from the sun, police helicopters, and law enforcement drones. According to a Chicago Tribune article, there are still, quote,
issues relating to the size of the route given the likely increase in the number of participants, and issues related to the potential for log jams on a route that uses smaller side streets remain and will unconstitutionally impede on the plaintiff's First Amendment rights.
Hatem Abudaya, national chair of the coalition-aligned U.S.-Palestinian Community Network, says the coalition has been advocating for a route 8 city blocks wide, regardless of its intersection with the Secret Service perimeter.
Why do they want the possibility that there's a big logjam here and for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, people are stopped because they got to make these 2 quick turns and there's tens of thousands of them? Why do they want the possibility that people, when they make this turn, they say, well, Washington Boulevard is wide open. I'm going to keep going down Washington Boulevard. The police threatened already that if we did that, that they were going to arrest people.
As predicted, the legal battle went incredibly close to the date of the march. On August 13th, the federal court decided on the side of the city, approving the route the coalition does not want. According to coalition spokesperson Fayani, the coalition would remain defiant and march their desired route regardless.
We've been saying since the beginning of this permit fight, since it started in January, we're going to march with or without a permit.
Okay.
There is an extenuating circumstance in the fact that there's a genocide happening where tens of thousands of people are now dead, millions of people displaced, tortured, just the most horrific shit that you see every day, excuse my language. That's and nice. So we recognize the extenuating circumstance and we're not gonna let whether or not we get a permit stop us. So we will march. The permit is just one way of many to try and protect people.
One last update before this episode has to be finalized. On August 15th, just 4 days before the protest, the city forbade the coalition from using stages, platforms, portable restrooms, tents, canopies, or sound equipment at Union Park, citing how there are going to be multiple groups protesting there. This doesn't make sense because the point of any permit is that a government gets to set the parameters on who does what. Hadem Abadaya of the coalition responded in a press release, quote, again, the city of Chicago has blindsided us and restricted our rights. We don't believe that any of the previous restrictions are content-based, but this one clearly is. Someone doesn't want us to talk about Palestine, about Genocide Joe and Killer Kamala's support of genocide, and this is an egregious violation of our rights, unquote. An emergency injunction has been filed, though this is unlikely to affect the outcome. Funny enough, another protest group was granted a permit. The Poor People's Army / Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, no association with the Poor Pearls Almanac, received their permit in early February because the city failed to approve or deny the request in the allotted 10-day response time, after which the request was automatically approved. That permit allows them to march to the United Center itself, though how close will likely come down to the Secret Service. Here's the thing about permits, applications, and all that head-spinning bureaucratic navigation. While it can look like groveling in a please-give-me-rights kind of way, it provides a level of legal coverage and makes your case stronger in the public eye if and when you don't get approved for them.
The way that we avoid a 1968 repeat is getting a permit. And I know a lot of people find that to be an unsexy thing. In my time organizing and in many of our time organizing, all my comrades and all the people that I'm with, none of us have applied for a protest permit, but this is an extenuating circumstance given that there are going to be tens of thousands of people and we want everyone from all walks of life, regardless of age, regardless of disability status, regardless of immigration status, to be able to partake in this march. And so the best way we can protect all of these people from police repression is to get a permit. And at the same time, we recognize that alone doesn't keep the police off your backs, because we know that 1968 began with police coming in and repressing people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in this struggle for a permit, you know, we have reached so many more people to bring into our struggle. At the same time, we have forced the state to make concessions. The state initially was only going to let us march 4 miles away from United Center. And it was through our struggle against the state in court that we were able to force it to give us a protest that was within sight and sound of United Center.
Asking for a permit and being denied might communicate to the uninterested third-party citizen that you had no other choice but to pursue your rights in the face of a government body denying them. This can also be massively abused, so the devil is in the details of that particular narrative, but this is often how more organized protest groups build their case. The bureaucratic process can become part of the narrative. One really funny example of this that I can't actually figure out comes from the Chicago Department of Transportation. On August 5th, CDOT announced it's providing a speakers platform and speaker system for pre-approved, time-slotted use at Park 578 by the United Center. The initial reactions on Twitter were naturally those of the what-the-fuck variety, but there's just something inherently funny about a government providing an application for people to criticize said government. At first glance, it looks like a sign of goodwill, but because the space is provided by the city, that also means it can take it away, or deny someone to speak based on whatever arbitrary rules it decides at that moment. Even if the city were to break a First Amendment right by doing so, the event will be long over by the time it reaches court. As of this recording, there hasn't been a consensus over how the protests will engage with this platform, if at all, but at the very least, it's kind of funny. Permits aren't the only thing raising eyebrows. The offices being rented for DNC organizers are owned by a known $2 million tax delinquent. In July, the city council was set to vote on amending the municipal code to make any gathering of 10 or more people between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. unlawful.
Jesus.
Yeah, no, that's kind of insane. Like, just, and it was that vague. Anyone during that time frame, just arrest them. It should be noted, though, the agenda was altered to not feature that vote at all. Encampments created by unhoused communities are being cleared for DNC-based beautification purposes, just as a new wave of migrants are expected to be bussed into the city from Republican states, sparking fears of a renewed migrant sheltering crisis. And Chicagoans aren't even quite sure how much of the bill they're going to foot for this whole thing. All of this stalling and missteps and associated platitudes shouldn't come as a surprise, but perhaps the biggest, most liberal move of all is how the Democrats held a virtual nomination for the presidential candidacy on August 5th, because some Democrat staffers couldn't get their calendars in order. This means Kamala Harris already is and will be the nominee before the DNC even begins. Many on the left were already upset they were robbed of the 2024 primary process from last winter and spring, and this virtual nomination is now seen as further theft of the democratic process from the people in favor of the Democrat Party elite. The coalition responded with the following statement, quote,
"When it comes to the genocide in Gaza, there is no difference between Biden, Harris, or any of the likely candidates for the nomination. They are all complicit. This is why the coalition will still be marching on the DNC in tens of thousands. We plan to have the largest march for Palestinian rights in Chicago's history as we demand an end to the genocide and an end to U.S. aid to Israel."
Beyond the Secret Service, Illinois State Police, and Cook County Sheriffs, a majority of the DNC's security, especially the handling of protesters, will fall on the Chicago Police Department and the prosecutors in the Cook County's Attorney's Office. How will they treat protesters? And where does their recent history put them in the context of the convention? In an April editorial piece, the Chicago Tribune reported that Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox is scrapping her 2020 policy of not prosecuting peaceful protesters. Note that that editorial thinks she should do so permanently. This decision was reportedly made specifically for the DNC in August. That's an about-face for what has been a reform-oriented attorney, beginning her tenure with the release of select nonviolent offenders who couldn't post bonds up to $1,000. When Illinois became the first state in the nation to eliminate cash bail altogether in 2023 under the Safety Act, Fox has reportedly implemented the necessary administrative reform to see it through, with early data showing there hasn't been any knee-jerk spike in crime. Still, she's been a lame duck since she decided not to run in 2024. Earlier protests this year beyond the aforementioned university encampments have occasionally resulted in arrests. In one instance, outside the Art Institute downtown, over 70 people, including students, were arrested right in the heart of the loop.
We're learning 68 people were arrested outside the Art Institute of Chicago yesterday. Now, this comes after hours of negotiations.
However, escalation from law enforcement was seen as proportional, and the most severe charge was criminal trespassing afterwards. In another instance, 40 people were arrested for blocking a highway entrance into O'Hare Airport as part of the A-15 economic blockade for Palestine. Those 40 protesters have been charged with relatively light misdemeanors, though they are urging the mayor to relent. Regardless, alarm bells have been rung about potential violations to Chicago's ongoing attempts at police reform. For Chicago, that reform is called the consent decree. Generically speaking, a consent decree is effectively a settlement agreement approved by a court. The consent decree came about in the wake of the 2014 murder of Laquan McDonald, where a cop shot the black 17-year-old 16 times in a span of 15 seconds. In the now infamous dashcam video, McDonald is seen brandishing a knife, but moving away from the officers. None of the officers attempted to render aid, and a cover-up ensued. The cop was convicted in 2018, though he only served 3 of his 7 years in prison, and all defendants in the alleged cover-up were found not guilty. The murder was enough to get the state of Illinois to file a complaint against the Chicago Police Department, alleging
CPD violates the Constitution and state and federal laws by engaging in a pattern of using excessive force, including deadly force, in a manner that disproportionately harms Chicago's African American and Latino residents.
Shortly thereafter, the U.S. Department of Justice investigated the CPD and came to the same conclusion. In 2019, a federal court established the consent decree after CPD acquiesced to the findings in that DOJ investigation. The consent decree calls for broad, constitutionally adhered reforms in the areas of, quote,
community policing, impartial policing, crisis intervention, use of force, recruitment, hiring and promotions, training, supervision, officer wellness and support, accountability and transparency, and data collection, analysis, and management.
Yeah, just a couple of things.
Just wanted to.
CPD's adherence to these reforms haven't been so great. And you can see a number of red boxes on the CPD's compliance webpage, where impartial policing and accountability have a lot of red boxes. In regards to the DNC, worries over police misconduct radiate from city inhabitants and officials, who are attempting to build and reinforce as many small legal protections as possible before the event. In addition to Kim Fox's protester policy change mentioned earlier, CPD's mass arrest policy was also put into question, with one federal judge claiming it eviscerates protections provided by the U.S. Constitution and the city. That policy has since been amended after much scrutiny, stating it will be a last resort option and that officers will not use unnecessary violence or retaliate against protesters. And even with a revision, there's still large gaps for the CPD to exploit when the protesting commences. In a June 27th federal court filing, a separate coalition of community organizations raised the following concerns over CPD's mass arrest policies.
Failure to distinguish between a First Amendment assembly and a crowd engaged in non-First Amendment activity, such as wide-scale looting.
Failure to distinguish between unlawful but nonviolent civil disobedience, such as sit-ins.
Failure to sufficiently instruct officers to use the least intrusive enforcement options consistent with public safety.
Allowing the use of action against large groups of people engaged in lawful protest due to the unlawful actions of a few.
Allowing the arrest of people engaged in First Amendment conduct for mere misdemeanors that pose no threat to anyone's physical safety or property.
Delayed reporting provisions for any use of force.
Insufficient restrictions on the use of pepper spray against nonviolent protesters.
Concern over the vague definition of, quote, lawful status in regards to a protest.
Concern over the definition of non-fatal major injury, which says an injury must be visible or require immediate transportation to a medical facility. This is especially important for accountability because a non-fatal major injury would require a much more detailed tactical response report from CPD.
And finally, the CPD is called out for failing to engage with the community members in an honest manner as required by the consent decree, instead forcing delays and the involvement of federal court.
Yeah, just a couple. As of this writing, no further revisions have been publicly released. Another common police tactic found at large gatherings, and one CPD is likely to use, is kettling. This popular tactic involves the envelopment of a protest or gathering by the physical bodies of officers, whereafter the protesters are either trapped on all sides and arrested, or provided specific exits by intentional gaps in the police line. I saw one example of this on a live stream during one of Chicago's 2020 protests. Police officers, each one with a bicycle, marched parallel to the demonstrators on the streets of downtown. When the time came, the cops rushed ahead and around the marchers to direct them towards a certain direction, using their bikes as a personal makeshift barrier. Anyone that resisted too much would get snatched, with a pair of bikes in the bike wall opening up before officers took them in. It almost looked like the bikes had eaten someone whole. The footage I'm referring to is from a Chicago Twitch streamer called Dirt McGirt, who was regularly doing streams from the city on his bike during the George Floyd uprisings. Unfortunately, it seems like this footage and most of the streams were unavailable for public viewing, though there is footage of the protest at the Christopher Columbus statue, which is a hilarious instance of bike cops failing to protect the statue of a crazed, disavowed, ultra-Christian genocider. You can see the bike cops using their cycles as barriers, though in this instance, they're using it to protect Christopher Columbus instead of to kettle.
Oh, they're starting to throw shit.
I just like the image of the cops protecting the statue. The cops are just starting to pull out altogether. They're just like, fuck this, it's a statue. It's just a statue.
Yeah.
Yeah, fuck it.
Later on, the protesters do try to pull the statue down like Saddam Hussein style. When the people were trying to pull it down, but they were unfortunately unsuccessful. And a week later, it was removed by the city and put into storage, where it has stayed for the past 4 years. And I don't think anyone really cares to bring it back. But that statue got fucked up a little bit. But yeah, that's kettling, except instead of protecting a statue, they're likely to enclose protesters like cattle.
Mm.
Good times. Technically speaking, CPD's most recent mass arrest policy prohibits kettling, instead using the term encirclement. Chicago's top cop, Police Superintendent Larry Snelling, explained the difference between kettling and encirclement, claiming, quote,
individual probable cause must have already been established prior to conducting the encirclement. This is different from kettling, which refers to police surrounding and detaining persons without the probable cause to do so.
The Chicago Inspector General, the city's official corruption watchdog, calls this out, claiming,
in its assessment of NYPD's response to events following the murder of George Floyd, encirclement tactics are, in practice, equivalent to what the public and media often call kettling.
All eyes are on CPD to keep its cool and see how hard it flirts with violating the First Amendment. That may be an increasingly tall order because of police administration canceling paid time off for officers during one of the busiest times of the year. Note the source is also one of the few instances of a police union actually engaging in labor, as opposed to intervening in police accountability. In a July 15th press conference, Police Superintendent Larry Snelling claimed,
all of our officers have gone through over 40 hours of field force training. Our officers are being trained in platoons to deal with large-scale protests. Now, that training is rooted in the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment, because those are the two most important things when we're dealing with large-scale protests. Number one, people's rights.
But up to 500 additional officers from outside CPD are coming to assist, though it wasn't specified where these officers would be allocated.
We have additional officers coming in, up to 500 officers. So we do have officers who are coming in to help out. That's going to free up some of our officers who have the training, the field force training, to be out in the field. So it's going to be helpful to us. We want to make sure that we're protecting everything, all of the venues that we can protect. But we also want to make sure that we keep the city safe as a whole. So we also have to protect neighborhoods during that time. So this will help us free up our Chicago police officers to make sure that they're available to respond to any crimes that are happening outside of the DNC footprint.
Probably the fucking donut tent, am I right?
Stan's Donuts downtown?
Mm-hmm.
They do have good donuts. The questions are especially pertinent since a man was shot and killed at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee by out-of-state police from Ohio on July 16th. According to reporting from the staff of Poor Pearl's Almanac collaborator, It Could Happen Here, locals said the police acted overzealously over an issue that could have been handled by the community.
So two guys had a little brawl, about the brawl, that's what it's called, about the fight. So they didn't really fight, and everyone on the bike, without saying police or stop or freeze, shot him. They emptied the clip. Every 12 officers on the bike emptied their clips, because you can see it cocked back.
Mm-hmm.
Emptied their clips, and then when they were done doing that, they turned the guns on us.
The killing by the Ohio police took place in the residential neighborhood of King Park, about a mile from the convention site at Five Sur Forum. Speaking of FOIA requests, on August 7th, Chicago-based news organization The Tribe reported that CPD would be getting a majority of the $75 million in federal funds provided specifically for the DNC. When The Tribe sent the request to see how that money would be distributed, they received a document bathed in the metaphorical black ink of a digital redacted marker. And real quick, I just want the reaction from this, and just start scrolling furiously through that document, please.
Oh man.
See, I feel like if you told Exhibit you liked black markers, this is what he would do to your life. Bro, hey, I heard you like black markers, so yeah.
Black markers on your black markers. It looks like an SCP document. I'm not even joking, if you know what that is. Someone in the audience will know what I mean by that.
Oh, so like in the breakdown, like way further down in it, personnel.
26 million.
In consultants, in contracts, so a lot of people.
Just a couple. All right. In December of 2023, the Chicago City Council voted largely in favor of a contract with CPD that covers a variety of topics, including salaries and arbitration. Notably, body camera policy was amended to include the following language, quote,
"Body cameras shall not be intentionally activated to record conversations with other employees with or without their knowledge during routine, non-law enforcement activities, including but not limited to surreptitious recordings of conversations with other members."
This vague language allows officers to effectively exclude certain footage and audio from the public record, since law enforcement activities and surreptitious recordings really comes down to personal judgment, and you can't go back in time to recover what was never filmed in the first place. Another section states, quote,
"Department members may review their body camera's recording of an incident prior to writing a report related to the incident. The member will document this fact in the narrative portion of the report. This includes but is not limited to case reports, arrest reports, tactical response reports, and investigatory stop reports."
This allows bad actors to potentially coordinate stories or a cover-up, or even dispose of recordings if they're that desperate. The implementation of body cameras has been a sea change in police accountability and how we fundamentally understand a community's relationship with the police. Chicago was an early adopter of body cameras, and by 2017, every patrol officer in the city was wearing one. In 2021, body camera footage became crucial information in the police killing of Adam Toledo, a Hispanic 13-year-old. CPD originally described the killing as an armed encounter, and after pressure from journalists, released annotated body cam footage with an arrow, a big red arrow, pointing to Toledo's hand holding a pistol. That same day, Chicago's Civilian Office of Police Accountability, or COPA, released footage that can be accessed on their website. COPA's raw footage showed Toledo tossing a pistol away just as Officer Eric Stillman commands,
"Please stop! Stop right fucking now! Hey, show me your fucking hands! Drop it! Drop it! Shots fired! Shots fired! Get an ambulance up here now! Look at me! Look at me! Look at me! You alright? Where are you shot?
Toledo complied with the order and turned around with his empty hands up. A fraction of a second later, Eric Stillman shoots Toledo dead. Many questioned why CPD didn't have an official foot pursuit policy, but rather a foot pursuits training bulletin, which sounds more like a suggestion. It's difficult to point out how Stillman could have better handled Toledo if there isn't an actual policy. The city tacitly agreed by implementing an official foot pursuit policy a year later. Stillman's fate is in limbo, similar to how Laquan McDonald's murderer took 5 years to be convicted. State's attorney Kim Fox declined to charge Stillman with a crime, citing insufficient evidence. COPPA did recommend Officer Eric Stillman to be fired, but as of this writing, his status as a police officer has yet to be heard by the Chicago Police Board, an independent office in charge of CPD disciplinary action. Even without a charge, body cameras played a marked role in exposing the shiftiness of the city's story over a 2-week period. In a timeline of events by USA Today, the police tweeted Adam Toledo's killing was an armed encounter, showing a picture of the pistol tossed aside by him before he was killed. Later, then-Mayor Lori Lightfoot described Toledo was in possession of a gun, which was technically correct right up until he complied with Eric Stillman to put the gun down. Later still, a Cook County prosecutor from Fox's office straight up said Toledo was holding the pistol when he was shot. Knowing how this narrative was playing out, Mayor Lightfoot then described Toledo as a child who was in contact with an adult who had a gun. Finally, CPD released its annotated version of the body cam footage, in a seemingly last-ditch effort to set the narrative. Again, to be clear, Adam Toledo was 13 years old. More recently, the July 6, 2024 killing of Sonia Massey in Springfield, Illinois, was also caught on police body cameras. That case is so bad that within 2 weeks, Sheriff Deputy Sean Grayson was fired for the killing, and he was indicted on 5 counts, including 3 counts of murder in the first degree.
You better fucking not, I swear to God, I'll fucking shoot you right in your fucking face.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Drop the fucking pot!
The fucking...
Drop the fucking pot! Drop the fucking pot!
19 shots fired!
Shots fired! Drop the fucking pot!
The videos and details are all online, but I did want to point out that Sonia Massey is the descendant of William Donegan, who was a black man lynched in the Springfield race riot of 1908. Donegan would die of his horrific injuries at the local St. John's Hospital, the same hospital where Massey was also pronounced dead. That specific race riot was the inciting incident that created the NAACP. In the aftermath of Sonia Massey being gunned down 116 years later in 2024, her surviving family reached out to the NAACP, completing a full circle in the most tragic way imaginable. And these are just the high-profile murders and killings by the entity that is the state. The struggle over police reform to try and end their violence has been long, frustrating, and marked by so many other smaller incidents and abuses. Often, the only reward for these reforms is the hope that less people will die. How all of that localized pressure and all of that momentum will or won't transfer to the protests at the DNC is a question that can only be answered there. Oh, and a report released by Chicago Public Media detailing how the Oath Keepers have on their roster dozens of former and current CPD officers. Yes, the January 6th insurrection Oath Keepers. In a statement released July 9th, the Chicago Inspector General found CPD's handling of said officers lacking, claiming,
"In practice, to date, the city's handling of extremism in the police ranks has fallen short. Any ongoing mishandling of the matter puts CPD's public legitimacy at critical risk and profoundly undermines its effectiveness by damaging the very public trust that the city and the department are endeavoring to foster."
If you're on a desktop computer, please take a look at that WBEZ report. The impact of scrolling through the assets and evidence, the way it's presented, hits way more. All right, we've been alluding to it for a while now, but I think it's finally time to go a few decades back to 1968. Earlier, I had mentioned one of the groups in a dispute with the city of Chicago over protest permits. the Students for a Democratic Society. If that group sounds familiar, it's because they cut their protesting teeth in this very city 56 years ago, with many of them leaving said teeth on the pavement in paddy wagons. Now, a million one takes have been made about America in the 1960s, but the one thing I want to emphasize is that the late 60s truly felt like a country coming undone in a way Americans didn't have to experience directly during World War II. It's a greatest hits from your local social studies books that include the meat grinder of Vietnam, Black liberation and the civil rights movement, LGBT uprisings, women's movements, crazy Cold War plots, and people recklessly trying new shit from LSD to homesteading. See a good number of Poor Pearl's Almanac episodes for details on that last one. Oh, and lead water. Everyone was drinking lead water. Today, that same feeling of things falling apart has reemerged, as well as some familiar themes. Black people still trying to matter. Russia is doing its imperialism in Europe again. An unprecedented hate campaign against the T in LGBT. And lead still in our pipes. Also, microplastics in our balls. Finally, capitalism's end boss, global climate change, is just starting to show its hand. I believe climate change is our nuclear threat. It's not a one-to-one parallel, but it's that looming cloud of end times that, should it come to pass, can potentially negate a positive outcome in everything else. The term collapse really took off during the 2020 pandemic and uprisings, but climate change is what the collapseware folks are really preparing for. We're actually going to cut this last section on the 68 convention a little shorter, simply because there are better sources that cover that whole thing. We just wanted to make some parallels and non-parallels in relation to 2024. If you want a more thorough look at the absolute brutality that was the 68 convention, take a look at episode 7 of Ken Burns' Vietnam series, about 25 minutes in. If you don't mind Aaron Sorkin's Libby, all-too-perfect dialogue, The Trial of the Chicago 7 is a mainstream Hollywood film that does capture a solid snapshot of the abuse from the state. And there's no bigger symbol of that abuse and no bigger symbol of Chicago's machine politics than Richard J. Daley. At the DNC, Mayor Daley attempted to put his thumb on the process with his imposing presence, yelling at other power players and wrangling delegates. As his police officers continued their beatings downtown, the chaos outside was seemingly matched inside as delegates clashed, crowds openly booed, factions feverishly filibustered, and journalists were hauled away during confrontations.
Take your hands off of me. Dan Ryan. Unless you intend to arrest me, don't push me, please. Yes, sir, I know you won't, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you intend to arrest me.
Wait a minute.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Walter, as you can see...
I don't know what's going on, but this these are security people, apparently, around Dan. They're obviously getting roughed up.
We tried to talk to the man, and we got bodily pushed out of the way. This is the kind of thing that's been going on outside the hall. This is the first time we've had it happen inside the hall.
I think we've got a bunch of thugs here, Dan.
And in case you didn't recognize those voices, that was Dan Rather getting pushed to the ground, and Walter Cronkite calling DNC security thugs. It was the most holistically contested convention of any party in modern times. And all of it was broadcast live on TV to 89 million people across the US, who saw the cuts between the outside and inside tank any hope for party unity. Later that year, thirsty for revenge, Daley would help persuade LBJ to pursue federal charges on the Chicago 7 through LBJ's attorney general.
You know what I'm trying to do? These fellas that have been harassing you for a year and a half, I think we got the dope on them once and for all on a conspiracy to riot. Mm-hmm. And if the attorney general goes along with us, I do think we'll expose the Rennie Davises, we'll expose the Tatons, we'll expose the Rubens, we'll expose the Shebagans, we'll expose the whole goddamn outfit and that mobilization for peace in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And we'll also include some of McCarthy's friends.
Yeah. But one of the biggest breaks in this 1968-2024 parallel is the 2024 Democrats coalescing around a single candidate, that being Kamala Harris. It may have simply been a matter of money since she was on the same ticket as Biden, but the fact remains she quickly became the anointed candidate in a follow-up tweet 30 minutes after Biden's initial announcement he's stepping down. If anything, the real contest was moved one step down the ticket to the vice presidency, which was narrowed down to about half a dozen candidates, ultimately going to Minnesota Governor and Midwestern progressive darling Tim Walz on August 6th. In the wake of Harris stepping up, the Democrats have had a fire lit under their ass. The selection of Walz even tossed a bone to the progressives, who have been banging their heads against the wall trying to find someone less aristocratic lawyer who volunteered in the Israeli Defense Forces and more, ah shucks, teacher dad, who marches on picket lines. As such, there's significantly less chance of 68 levels of disorder inside the actual DNC. Maybe some individual jeers from the crowd, and we won't know any of the backroom dealings until after the fact, but you probably won't see Mayor Brandon Johnson yelling expletives at Gavin Newsom from the front row. So the real question is, of course, the outside protests from the people and how they'll interact with the police lines. In 1968, the Yippies of the Youth International Party were honestly kind of trolls at the event, but weren't afraid to stand at the protest lines. Led by the incomparable Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, they nominated a pig named Pigasus for president while in Chicago, and brought some music to the downtown areas in their usual leftist revolutionary ways. The Students for a Democratic Society of 1968 de facto represented the many young students from the University of Illinois, University of Chicago, and other colleges across the country. Organizing things at the top of this ragtag collection was the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam, or simply, the MOB. There were certainly other groups and unaffiliated individuals who protested, but those were some of the standout groups. They were also the groups whose leaders comprised most of the Chicago Seven, a fascinating cross-section of the American left during that era. But here in 2024, the Coalition to March on the DNC is the closest parallel we have to the MOB, seeing how they've de facto been the face of the most street-level protests planned to happen. The new Students for a Democratic Society were established in 2006 after the original SDS broke into factions in 1969, and the 2006 group cut their teeth protesting the Iraq War. Now, the national new SDS and their chapters at five universities, including UIC, have committed to the coalition's protest. As for any modern yippies, you're not likely to find them. By my estimation, the modern protest movement learned a lot from the messiness of the 60s counterculture movement, particularly how many of that generation wound up becoming boomers that neither passed on their wealth or built an ideal world. Honestly, if there were going to be any yippies in 2024, they'd all be online making the longest YouTube essays, the loudest debate streams, the quippiest tweets, and the dankest memes. They'd be bread tubers, effectively. However you slice it, thanks to the internet, the average protester has a lot more tools and information at their fingertips to be more effective. Occupy Wall Street was a first steps protest moment for the millennials, and the George Floyd uprisings gave a real hard launch to Gen Z as well, so there's been a lot of practice. But even with all that power, it's important to remember how history can be a cruel thing to read. Contemporary public sentiment in the wake of the 68 DNC was against the protesters, not the police. To quote an article from the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research,
"The country certainly appeared to sympathize with the police more than the protesters. In a Gallup poll, 56% approved of the police response to anti-war protesters, and 31% did not. In a Harris survey, 66% agreed that Chicago Mayor Daley was right in the way he used police against the demonstrators, against only 20% who disagreed. Just 14% in the same poll agreed that protesters had had their rights to protest taken away, 66% who did not."
The article goes on, discussing the Chicago 7 trial presided by its infamous judge, Julius Hoffman.
"In the immediate aftermath of the trial, most Americans were still not on the demonstrators' side. A Harris poll in March 1970 found half of the country had followed the trial. Of those, 71% thought the defendants had gotten a fair trial, and 63% said the judge had done an excellent or pretty good job. Only 31% thought he had, in quote, lost his head and acted improperly, while 59% did not. 71% agreed that his, in quote, patience was worn thin, and he was justified in cracking down on the defendants and their lawyer."
The whole world was watching, and they were fine with what they saw. Now, I'm not going to sit here and talk into my podcasting microphone telling the people staring down an encroaching armored police wall what they should and shouldn't do. What's moral? what's shrewd, what's right, what's politically smart, what looks good for a tweet, what looks good for a Reuters news package, or a Fox News pundit. Dressing in your Sunday best worked for the NAACP in the 1960s, but does that really work today with an establishment that is used to these tactics and a conservative apparatus that knows how to exploit it? Jane Fonda's tour through North Vietnam highlighted some of the atrocities of U.S. foreign policy. But was it a net good if the NVA successfully used her image for propaganda that was so effective, that's all anyone remembers? I don't have that level of foresight. What I am suggesting is how vindication can come swiftly, but it can also take decades. You might not even live to see it. For many people in history, it still hasn't happened yet. Maybe you are backing the wrong horse. What I believe is most important for the politically inclined is to keep developing your morals, your principles, and your wisdom. Beware of charlatans and cult leaders like Andy.
Andy. Jesus Christ.
That fucking guy.
And keep the questions constantly firing in your head. That doesn't mean you need to be a policy wonk or know everything. That's the point of this entire podcast. You just have to keep trying. Long after the protest has ended. Sometimes quietly, but always trying. So even when the movements ebb and flow, you can have a little bit of yourself figured out. Speaking of ebbing, the chaos of the 1960s ultimately set up a conservative thunder run, beginning with Richard Nixon in 1968. So was it all worth it? To give way to Nixon and Reagan? You can decide that for yourself. But history shows that people power is always a force to be reckoned with.
I would say something that I would emphasize is we in the coalition recognize a lot of people in this country have a conscience, as has been shown by the huge upswell in support for Palestine, historic, not just in Chicago, but all around the country, and the brave rebellions from students in the week-to-week protests going on around the country, the continuous bird-dogging of politicians. Like, people in this country have shown themselves to have a consciousness. And, you know, we want to unite with all those people of conscience to put pressure on these politicians to end the genocide. We recognize that change is not going to come from within those parties. Change will have to come from out of it through a mass movement. And so, you know, we hope that whoever's listening, plug into what we're doing and see how you can get involved with this struggle for free Palestine, this struggle to end the genocide, because, you know, we're going to need to all be in it together. And so that's what I would say my final words are. Thank you.
Stay safe out there. And remember, as Andy always says, together we can build a better future.
Fuck that guy. What the fuck's that guy know?
As we say, build back better.
Yes, we can.